If the committee members would, going from left to right, introduce themselves.
I'm Mick Anderson, representing the 3rd District.
Ron Blau, representing the 1st District.
John Gilby, representing the 4th District.
Tammy McConnell, Orange County EMS.
Sam Stratton, Orange County EMS.
Michelle Tom, Society of Emergency Medicine.
Wolfgang Canabi, representing Orange County Fire Chiefs Association.
Margie Harrier, representing Orange County Business Council.
Sharon Hoyer, representing Orange Coast Emergency Nurses Association.
Patrick Powers, representing the 2nd District.
Philip Davis, representing the Ambulance Association.
Thank you, everyone. If the members would mind reviewing the minutes from the agenda from last meeting, and we could get an approval.
A motion approved.
Second.
Thank you. Minutes approved. Going to OCMS report, medical director update. Sam?
Yes, starting with the standing orders, we have revised standing orders that are posted now on our website that will be going into effect on September 2nd. And those can be found at the bottom of the standing orders column of the standing orders that are in effect at the present time, again, on the Orange County EMS website. A number of policies have gone through 15-day public comment. Most of those will be going into effect. The one policy that we received the most comments on was the mass gathering policy, and we received very few comments before the deadline, but a number after, so we're still reviewing those. Currently, we have policies up for 50-day public comment, again, on the website. That includes the EMT accreditation and the EMT scope of practice revisions that were made there, primarily adding hemostatic dressings, which is become approved at the state level. The ALS unit inventory policy is also up for comment, and the one that seems to be garnering the most interest is the AMA liability release policy, which is up currently for public comment. We also have the OC Meds management and support policy, which is up for 50-day public comment. So if anyone has interest in any of those policies, please check them out on the Orange County EMS website. And there are instructions on how to provide comment through the electronic comment system that we have. Further on the medical director update, we have received interest from Children's Hospital of Orange County that they will be proposing to come up as a children or pediatric trauma center this summer, and our intent is to use the American College of Surgeons Green Book. It's a book of standards, and we'll do initially a provisional survey and audit of children's and or CHOC. And our expectation is that we would, if everything's okay, provide provisional pediatric trauma center designation. And then in 2015, concurrent with UCI's evaluation by the American College of Surgeons, have that group, who commonly does trauma center surveys throughout the United States, include CHOC to become a permanent or a regular, if you will, a designated trauma center, pediatric trauma center in Orange County. So maybe I could stop here and ask if the members of the committee have any questions at all or comments. Okay. Continuing on. The OC Meds update. OC Meds, we currently have the licensing function, or licensing is fully functional on OC Meds, so electronic submission of licenses and accreditation applications are, again, fully functional on OC meds. That includes paramedics and EMTs. Currently, all paramedic or ALS level services are submitting data through OC meds. And at the bottom of the agenda, we'll go through what some of that data is showing when we talk about core measures that have been submitted. Excuse me. So OC Meds is up and functioning with the licensing module now online. This is important because in before this electronic licensing came up, EMTs and others had to come to the office. Many of you know the parking for 10 minutes to walk into our office is about one day's pay for many EMTs. So this is, I think, a much better service for EMTs in particular, as well as paramedic accreditation. It allows for online application rather than having to show up in person with a bunch of paperwork that has to be reviewed, and in particular parking in downtown Santa Ana. Going further to the third bullet, the EMCC correspondence, our office is not aware of any correspondence that has been received since the last meeting that we had. So that completes our OCEMS report and correspondence.
Thank you, Sam. Next agenda is EMCC Advisory Subcommittee and Advisory Group reports.
So I'll take that. It'll be another quick item. The Facilities Committee and CPAC, which have met since our last meeting, were both those time slots in those meetings were, if I can use in quotes, commandeered, close quotes, for public comment and public discussion of the upcoming Orange County EMS ambulance RFP. So the meetings were dedicated to discussion of RFPs that are being conducted by Orange County EMS. And the content structure and comments regarding the RFPs, as well as developing changing 19 exclusive operating areas and combining those into five larger exclusive operating areas. So facilities and CPAC were addressing that issue and had no other agenda items. Transportation met this past Wednesday, and I'll have to defer to someone who was at that meeting because I just returned from Sacramento late Wednesday night. So I think
Patrick, did you want to comment?
Sure, I'll talk. Mr. Jim Karras is the chairman of Transportation Advisory. I was in attendance. Some of the items that we talked about were the new ambulance rules and regulations that have been put into effect as of 4/1/2014, the changes that many of the companies will have to go through in order to be in compliance with the new policies. We had a discussion regarding the enforcement mechanism by the agency on the new policies, given that there is a vacancy currently in the ALS and the BLS coordinator. As well, a further discussion took place in regards to the ambulance ordinance and formation of a small task group in order to take a look and, at the direction of the agency, attempt to revise or make suggestive revisions to the ambulance ordinance. So a small task group was formed, and I think that went back to the agency for report, and we're waiting to move forward.
Thank you.
So the ambulance ordinance has will come under the Transportation Committee in the task force that Mr. Powers just discussed. That will be coming to the full EMCC for discussion and action to make recommendations to the Board of Supervisors for revision of that ordinance. The last ordinance, I believe, was from the 1980s and is, in many people's opinion, outdated at this time. So that will be gradually become a major item for this this group to evaluate and discuss. And then further advisory group meetings, education and training did not meet. There was a conflict with, I think, a Board of Supervisors meeting at the time. So they will meet, I believe, next week.
Okay.
And that completes our committee report.
The next item is unfinished business. First, the Emergency Medical Services Plan, public comments.
The EMS plan was submitted to, it's actually the draft plan was submitted to the California EMS Authority and is posted on our website also. The plan, which is over 250 pages, describes the EMS plan. In as it's required in state statute that that plan be submitted for essentially for Orange County statutorily to have a EMS program that involves advanced life support. It centers on that primarily, but it also obviously moves to basic life support also. The plan was open for comments, and we received a large number of comments, most of which were corrections, for example, changing basic emergency designation that we had in the plan as a basic emergency department for a hospital to a comprehensive emergency department, making sure that a company had incorporated, added to its name as opposed to just the working name for the company. So many of those changes are non-substantial typo or simple corrections that are being made. The most common concern and discussion we received was regarding exclusivity and non-exclusivity of various operating areas in the county, centering around the discussion that we had, I believe, either last meeting or the meeting before regarding what's called 201 and 224. The letters we've received are appeals to have a area changed on the plan from generally non-exclusive to exclusive. And we're taking those letters and we'll begin working internally along with our county counsel, our county attorney, and begin to collect the data for those areas that wish to be reevaluated. We'll collect the data and information required for the state to evaluate whether a entity can be grandfathered under what's called 224, the statutory definition of exclusivity or antitrust protected areas or not. So we have those letters, a large number of comments, and we'll be evaluating those and moving forward with that. So I think that's the primary thing with the plan. I should stop and ask if there are any questions or comments at this point.
Dr. Schrein, I have a question. I know the issue with exclusivity and 224, some of the comments and some of the concerns were that cities, departments, districts were improperly put in under 224. They should have been 201. 201 supersedes 224. So I think part of it is a lot of those agencies shouldn't even be considered under that document. They should be under 201. Is that being addressed also?
Well, the 201, the 201 is a, this will be a highly technical discussion, and maybe I should find 201 in my book and read it so everybody knows what we're talking about. I should have already had it marked, but just give me a second. So this is a health and safety code statutes, and these are statutes that are in effect as of this January. It's a long paragraph, but I should read it. This is 1797.201. Upon the request of a city or fire district that contracted for or provided as of June 1, 1980, pre-hospital emergency medical services, a county shall enter into a written agreement with the city or fire district regarding the provision of pre-hospital emergency medical services for that city or fire district. Until such time that an agreement is reached, and this is the area of contention, so until such time that there's an agreement between essentially the county and the city or fire district, pre-hospital emergency services shall be continued at not less than the existing level, and the administration of pre-hospital EMS by cities and fire districts presently providing such services shall be retained by those cities and fire districts, except the level of pre-hospital EMS may be reduced where the city council or the governing body of a fire district pursuant to a public hearing determines that a reduction is necessary. So this policy goes back to Lomita 1. It was a decision in LA County and Lomita from the 1980s, or this is not a policy, but it's a paragraph in the statute that ensures that cities and fire districts are not, that they can go ahead and administer, so this is contract for ambulance services, if they have not changed the essentially character or scope of the services that they've provided, and they've been continuously provided since the essentially June 1, 1980, when the paragraph was, it refers to, it wasn't written in 1980, but it goes to 1980. So it's a protective clause for cities to prevent the county from saying that we will administer EMS for you and when that city is already contracting for that service and all. So 201, if you look at 201, nowhere in there in what I just read does it discuss whether the county or the state has anything to do with 201. So statutorily, it appears that 201 is a issue that is a city issue or a fire district issue, but there's no authority within 201 for the county to have any say based on this statute with regard to yes or no 201 status. So that's why in the plan, as with most of the other plans, there's no reference to 201. It's the reference is to 224, which let me find that. I apologize. I was going to put these on a slide, but I kept getting distracted in the office. So anyway, 224. So this is, again, out of the statutes. 224 addresses the creation of exclusive operating areas. We had a long discussion about this at a prior meeting, and this all centers around antitrust protection for exclusive operating areas that are designated by the local EMS agency. So 224 states that a local EMS agency may create one or more exclusive operating areas. And the term exclusive, and remember there was a slide show that I had, exclusive is equal to antitrust protection. So a local EMS agency may create one or more exclusive operating areas in the development of a local plan if a competitive process is utilized to select the provider or providers of the services pursuant to the plan. No competitive process is required if the local EMS agency develops or implements a local plan that continues the use of existing providers operating within a local EMS area in the manner and scope in which the services have been provided without interruption since January 1, 1981. And then it goes on to discuss other things. So the what we can, as a local EMS agency, address is 224, which I just read, because it specifically relates to an EMS agency, a local EMS agency. But paragraph 201 does not provide any authority or jurisdiction to either the local EMS agency or the state. So throughout California, the plans will refer to 224, but not 201 for that reason.
Yeah, I guess the issue is with these cities and districts is that if they have the 201 rights, there's no reason to be mentioned in 224 because they have the ability to they have the ability to provide the service they were already providing. And I think the issue was, and a lot of the correspondence that came in, is we shouldn't even be mentioned under 224 because we have our 201 rights, those types of things. And I think some cities got a letter from the county council stating, hey, you have your 201 rights, continue on. And I think that's just where other cities and districts within the county, within the LEMSA, just want the ability to know is if the LEMSA considers them 201 cities or 224, and that way, you know, they can go, you know, decide what course of action they take, and you know, and that's the big issue there. And I know you're at LEMSA is you're extremely overworked and understaffed, and that's a whole other issue. And when I talk to the state, when I talk to Dan Smiley at the state, they say that's a LEMSA decision. It's not our decision. So it seems like LEMSA, the EMSA is saying LEMSA makes that decision, and you know, we're saying, well, the state's making that decision. So
we've discussed this with the state, and we'll take the letters that we received that were actually in comment to the EMS plan and begin to collect the data to show that the manner and scope for those areas that, and it's usually cities that are concerned about having exclusivity based on the fact that they haven't changed manner and scope, essentially that they've either contracted or provided the services that do get antitrust protection. Excuse me. We'll collect that data, and the state has agreed to review it for us and give us a determination. But the state's the one that has the sanctioned antitrust protection, not the county. The county does, though, have the responsibility for identifying operating areas as described in 224, and also identifying those that may grandfather. Now, the grandfathering is very similar to 201, and in fact, 224 further down says that 224 cannot supersede 201. But it's important to understand that 201 is not something that the county or the state has any authority or jurisdiction over. That's the courts. So it's likely somewhere in the state this issue will be resolved at the court, in the court system, as opposed to any other. Although the state has what's called a Chapter 13 committee, which is trying to make the definitions more clear for defining the grandfathering, which would secondarily define likely 201 for the courts. It's also extremely important for everyone in Orange County to understand that the only thing we're talking about here is emergency ambulance transport. Orange County, as most of California, does not include ALS. In the definition of ALS is paramedic services, critical care transport, anything above, anything that involves advanced life support defined as anything above the level of an EMT. Orange County, no other, most other counties do not have designated, elected, or do not, if you will, set up exclusive zones and operating for ALS. Let's put it that way. In Orange County, in fact, and this is with discussion with the state, would not even be eligible to do that because we've had critical care transport since the origins of the county EMS system, transporting across city lines, and critical care transport is by definition considered ALS. So there are only two, there's really three types of areas where exclusivity is granted or considered under 224. Emergency transport, emergency ambulance transport, which is the ambulances responding to 911 calls. There's advanced ALS, limited ALS in rural areas that does not apply to Orange County. And ALS, which is all the different forms of ALS that we have in Orange County, but primarily it's critical care transport and paramedic transport, retriages, as well as 911, and then the add-on of the IFT ALS a year or so ago.
Other committee comments?
Yeah. Dr. Stratton, I have read over the comments that have been submitted by the cities and their legal counsel and their opinion of 201, and I'm particularly concerned in the obstinance of the cities in which they command that they are insistent of being recognized as 201. Their unwillingness to cooperate with the EMS agency in developing an organized EMS system is concerning. In addition, we have now seen pilot programs being requested by the ALS providers in some of these cities in question, in which they look to expand their role of EMS and the provision of their EMS services. You went on to read the provision of 1797.201, in which the statute clearly states that the city may not decrease their level of service unless they have a vote by their city council. Nothing in that statute allows them to increase the provision of service. And I think that until such time that a city decides to enter into a contract with the LEMSA for the provision of EMS services, no pilot program should be allowed to expand the provision of their services.
I'll take that as a comment.
Any other committee comments?
You know, I would have to, Dr. Stratton, respectfully disagree with the gentleman. And, you know, the legislation, 1797-21, is extremely clear and that the cities have those rights and obligations under the law until they enter in an agreement with the LEMS. And the whole issue is, I think the cities, the districts, they're more than happy to get together with the LEMSA and finalize this whole thing. And people that have 201 rights recognize that, say that they have them. People that don't recognize that, I mean, that could be handled right now. So it's not a matter of not wanting to do it. In Orange County, we just don't want to go by the way of many cities and districts in this state where they've lost their ambulance services for one reason or another due to the companies going out of business, things of that nature. We're all in this together wanting to ensure the best EMS system possible. But we also have to do what 1797-201 says, because that's the legislative intent. But many of these cities, these districts, would love to enter into an agreement if those rights are protected.
To respond, as I stated in the previous meeting, I would argue that cities have entered into agreements for the licensing of ambulance companies and the provision of EMS, as identified in Orange County EMS Policy 720, Addendum Number 2. And in that policy, it identifies that the county created a model ambulance ordinance for the regulation of EMS services, and many cities within this county adopted that model ambulance ordinance for the provision of licensing of EMS services. So I would argue that those contracts exist between the cities and the LEMSA.
Okay. Thank you, committee members, for the discussion. Due to limited time, we're going to move forward to the next item. Under unfinished business, ambulance request for proposal process.
So many of you, I think, are aware that in October, late October, Orange County EMS was mandated by the state EMS authority to define the legal basis for delegation of ambulance contracting for Orange County Fire Authority cities in Southern California, in the southern part of the county. And it actually was 19 cities that are up for renewal. August 31 is when those contracts expire. We've had three public hearings. I've also spoke momentarily before the Fire Authority Board more about the EOA construction or the zone construction, and then address this issue four times in open forum before the Board of Supervisors. So there's been a large amount of public discussion of this matter and all. It is particularly difficult for our office because we have a very tight timeline before contracts expire. The interesting thing is for these 19 cities, this discussion we just had about 201 and 224, it all centers on 224. None of the cities meet the criteria for administering their own ambulance contracts. Those come under the county. In a sense, de facto, although this has been discussed at the state and there's some confusion, in that if a city is not a 201 city, there's no statutory, if you will, organized way for that city to actually administer its contracts. It really comes under the EMS system as opposed to independent of it. So anyway, we are have a RFP, a request for proposals, that has been circulated heavily throughout not just Orange County but the state, that's at the office of the EMS authority. Myself and Tammy McConnell next to me here, as well as other representatives of the county, met with the state EMS authority this week, discussed some of their concerns about the RFP, and currently are in the process of addressing those concerns that were discussed in a meeting. We understand also that the fire authority and some city representatives met with the EMS authority and discussed some of their concerns, so we expect to hear back what came of that meeting. We were not a party to that meeting, we'll proceed with the RFP hope to have the RFP conducted. It actually was due for release today, so I'm sure there are members of the audience that are wondering if it's going out today. While all this was going on, the Board of Supervisors elected to request a one-year extension for the process, the RFP, and the awarding of the contracts. A letter was sent to the EMS authority by the Board of Supervisors and the healthcare agency, and we're in discussion with the EMS authority on that, and pending discussions on that extension letter, we'll then release the RFP. The reason for that is that the RFP has very tight timelines in it, and if there is any extension, the RFP would have to be revised anyway with the timeline. So at the present time, we're in discussion with the EMS authority regarding a letter requesting extension from primarily from our Board of Supervisors. So that maybe I should ask if the committee has any questions.
No questions. Good. Okay, moving on in the agenda, the next item is new business. If the committee members will turn to attachment 4, ground ambulance service rate increase. Tammy?
So in your packet, you have a few items. There was a memo released to all of the fire chiefs, Orange County ambulance providers, and also the cities, noticing them that the annual proposed annual rate adjustment was going to be looked at by this committee today. This is to offer anybody an opportunity to come and speak for or against. Typically, by this time, I would have received letters of non-support or, no, we don't think the rate should be increased, but I haven't. If I do before the next meeting, I'll provide that. But essentially what this is a notice that we are using our board-directed process to determine what the annual rate adjustment will be. So the table on the last part just illustrates the current rate and then the proposed increase of 1.1%, what the new rate would look like. That methodology is based on looking at the all items CPI for Los Angeles, Riverside, Orange County between years 2012 and 13. So that's the calculation. That's the how the adjustment would look on the rate. Also within your packet is just a history of ambulance rates in Orange County and how they have been developed, as well as the authorities behind it. So it's mainly for your review and for your digestion until June, when the most likely the Ambulance Association and possibly OCFA will come and do a presentation on their rates and on the rate adjustment, and then ask for your support for a letter to be forwarded to the Board of Supervisors for them to opine on whether or not they'll adjust the rate.
Any committee comment, member?
One question. I remember last time we discussed this, Tammy, I think the presentation was made, and I think our Orange County rates are, and maybe it's changed, but you know, maybe you can shed some light on it, are still amongst the lowest in the the lowest in the state.
They are. Yeah.
I mean, even with this increase.
Yes.
Any other comments? Okay. Thank you, Tammy. The next item on the agenda is the City of Anaheim Community Care Response Unit, Attachment 5.
You're welcome.
Go ahead. Proceed.
Good morning. I'm Randy Bergman. I'm the Fire Chief with the City of Anaheim, and it's a pleasure for me to be here this morning. I'd like to give you an overview of a pilot project that we have submitted, actually starting late last year, that went to the state, and we would like to give an overview to this group, and we would seek your support to move forward with this pilot over the course of the next fiscal year. It's called a community care response unit, and it couples a paramedic and a nurse practitioner field application. Many of our calls, as I think most of your fire service providers know, and I think County EMS knows, about 40% of our calls are low acuity calls that come through the 911 system. And oftentimes, we are transporting individuals to the emergency room that may not need that level of care. Unfortunately, that's a very expensive way to do business. So we began to start to research exactly what we wanted to do in the future. And we started with our own strategic planning process that began in 2011. We brought our community together along with our internal personnel and city department directors, and we asked ourselves these three basic questions. And I think these are relevant for most organizations today, is how do we become more competitive in the future? How do we create value specifically for us beyond the 911 call? And then how do we re-engineer and retool our profession for the future? Because there are a lot of changes, not only in EMS for the fire service, but then as the fire service in general and local government. So I think these are very fundamental questions that we started with as part of our strategic planning process. Along the same time, we also received a grand jury report from Orange County, and several of these reports have been issued throughout the state. Really focusing on the fire service and asking a really basic question is, why does the fire service continue to send big red fire trucks to all of these low acuity calls? And while we took exception, I know the fire chiefs had a lot of discussion about the grand jury report, and we took exception with some of the comments that were made in there. This is a relevant question. Because we have a model that was designed many years ago, and we're an all-hazards agency, so we respond to everything. But we respond to that at the same level all the time. That's in a very expensive way to do it. It also creates issues for us on the other side from just a deployment and resource allocation standpoint, that when we have that major call, when we really need to bring the force together to address it, sometimes they're out of position. So we began to research exactly what alternatives existed, not only within the state of California, but throughout the nation. And about the same time, the Affordable Health Care Act was signed by President Obama, and then, of course, we had to go through the kind of the legal issue with that to see if that was going to hold or not, and we did that, so it gave us a little bit of time. But I think all of us know the Affordable Health Care Act is promoting integration and shared responsibility, and at the same time looking for innovative ways to lower cost, because health care is an expensive vehicle. And so we have to find more innovative ways to not only affect cost containment, but also provide better service to our customers. And that's a challenging thing to do. So we started to research throughout the country, and about the same time we started to have discussions in this state about the expansion of community paramedicine, what that might look like, interfacility transport discussion that we had here several months ago, and just looking for alternative ways to address our healthcare in the field. We looked at community paramedicine, and we're fairly limited here just with scope of practice within the state of California. And to change scope of practice for a paramedic to really facilitate doing some of the things that are being done in Minnesota and Texas and other states will probably take a fair amount of time and a fair amount of energy and may or may not ever happen. But we landed on a pretty unique concept that Mesa Fire in Mesa, Arizona, in a local hospital developed in about, actually they started talking about this in about 2008, actually implemented in 2010 and 2011. And they called it their transitional response vehicle, where they coupled a paramedic and a nurse practitioner because their analysis was the same as ours. And in fact, I think if you took most fire service providers today and looked at what their call breakdown is, you would see that the top 10 to 15 low acuity calls are relatively the same. It doesn't make a difference whether you're running 3,000 calls or 300,000 calls. That breakdown is relatively the same. So we're seeing the same type of issues arise in departments that deal across the spectrum with different type of geographies, different states. It's the same issue. They found that coupling a nurse practitioner and a paramedic allowed them to do a couple of things. One is to treat and release in the field, so that they would go on many calls in the field that historically would be just taken to the emergency department. Because once we engage, and if they do need some level of care, we have to take them to the ED. That's an expensive venture, as you all know. Not only from our side, but from your side as well. It's also time-consuming for the paramedics, the transport providers, our paramedics, your staff. And so they launched this program as a pilot to see if it would work. And what they found, and I'm going to show you just a short video clip, and then we'll talk about some of their experience that they've had since they've launched this program.
Locations.
Let's talk about things that work.
Locations.
Let's talk things that work. This is work. The Mesa Fire Department getting some national attention for a program that began back in August. It's an idea to help with overcrowding in emergency rooms. Fox 10's Mark Martinez has been looking into it. He joins us live with the story. Mark.
Yeah, John, it's quite the idea. For the past 6 months, a Mesa fire captain has been teamed up with a nurse practitioner to respond to low-level emergencies. The idea is to treat people on the scene so they don't have to go to the ER, even writing prescription. It's almost like a primary care provider. It looks like just another ambulance, but think of this more like an urgent care on wheels. Mesa Fire Medical teaming up with Mountain Vista Hospital, pairing up Fire Captain Brent Burgett and nurse practitioner Tom Morris to respond to low-level emergencies.
It's probably a lot more cost-effective to do something like this than it is to hire more people in the emergency department and to expand emergency departments.
We went on a ride-along today to see the team in action. This man called for help after hurting his back while pushing a car.
I'm going to get some vital signs. I'm going to put some ice back there, and we're going to get you something for pain, okay? Sound good?
Yeah.
Right on.
After about 20 minutes of treatment, the man was able to walk out of the ambulance, avoiding a trip to the ER.
As a nurse practitioner, I'm able to go into patients' homes. I'm able to go onto the street, the places where emergencies happen or urgencies happen, and deliver care there as opposed to in the hospital emergency department.
And it also frees up the other firefighters to respond to more serious calls.
Cardiac arrest, strokes, all the very high urgency calls, these engines and ladders are going to be available because we're on a low-level emergency that they may have been tied up on.
And nearly 80% of the department's calls are for medical cases. Fire departments from other states are now looking at this program to see how it works. The city will test this program out for about a year and then evaluate to see if it will become a permanent setup. Reporting live, Mark Martinez, Fox 10 News.
So what have they learned in the first year? Well, the first year they learned that the system worked, worked very well. They have estimated that in the first year with this one unit that was in service, they saved not the city, but the healthcare system about $3 million from just going through the traditional model of just taking them to the hospital, which is pretty significant. The other ancillary thing that has happened is other providers have come to the table. Those providers are mental health, behavioral specialists, substance abuse specialists, and now they have additional cars that have been placed in service to address those areas specifically with people that are trained specifically to address those. Now, we all know, and we go on these calls every day, people that are deemed 5150, that are chronic substance abuse, have chronic substance abuse issues, and what do we do as paramedics? We evaluate, we put them in the back of a transport unit, we take them to emergency department, and especially the behavioral issues, sometimes they will reside in the emergency department for not 2 or 3 hours, but sometimes 2 or 3 days, because we're waiting for them to be assessed by the county and released. And that's very, very expensive, not only from transport, but just the amount of staff time, bedtime, and all that. So very expensive. The same is true with the substance abuse, especially those people that are chronically abusing. And we see them often. We see the same patients over and over again. And it's like Groundhog Day, because we relive and we redo the same thing over and over again, sometimes multiple times a month. What they have found is that they've brought two cars on that specifically deal with that. And so instead of taking them to the emergency department, they actually take them to facilities that can begin to help them not come back and to really address the problem. So they've seen other medical providers see the benefit in this in treating in the field and getting them to the medical help that they need. The right medical care, the right time in the first place, and so we think that's pretty important outgrowth of what they have learned. Now, when we started this process, we reached out to Kaiser Permanente of Orange County. and our transport provider in the city of Anaheim, Care Ambulance. And we asked them if they would consider piloting a project with us, or proposing this pilot project with us. And after several months of discussions, we came to conclusion that this was a viable thing to do. And so we have been working with both of our partners to kind of frame this process up. We've also talked to all of our other hospitals in the city of Anaheim, and three of the four of them are very supportive of this. The fourth is somewhat reluctant because of the diversion from the emergency department, but understands the benefit from especially with the behavioral health and substance abuse issues. So I think as we pilot this, that'll be one of the things that we'll have to evaluate, is what the breakdown of the numbers are and what the impact is on the system. But we think this concept better aligns medical response efforts with some of the things that we're seeing in the field, and provides our ability to redeploy resources much more effectively as we look to the future. We think that sometimes you need to go out and test and demonstrate to validate if there is actually potential in the long run. And that's what we're asking to do. I don't know in the future. I think there was a comment made whether we were expanding our scope of service. We can have that discussion in a minute. But the reality is, I think this is a process that we need to test. It's not unlike the interfacility transport process that we went through. It's not unlike the several studies that are going along in the state on community paramedicine about diversion and a whole host of other things, because I think we're at a time and a crossroads looking at alternative deployment with EMS and allied medical services, and I think the alignment is actually going to grow closer in the future. I think it's going to be driven closer in the future because of the Affordable Health Care Act. And so I think we have to be open to the concept of looking at innovative ideas like this and seeing if they'll work for us or not. And the only way we're going to find that out is to actually test it out. So how does this work? Calls come into the 911 or screened just as they are today by the emergency medical dispatch, and those patients that are deemed low acuity and may have an opportunity for this type of unit, that unit would be deployed. I get several questions on why don't you just send two nurse practitioners out, and there's a reason for that. We kept a paramedic on here, and the same, and this is a good lesson learned from Mesa. When you couple a paramedic and a nurse practitioner, you have two different sets of skills and levels of knowledge. The nurse practitioner there is there to treat and release in the field. But if they find that they walk into a situation, which often happens, it will happen many times today throughout this county, by the way, where we will be dispatched on what we think is a low acuity call, and we walk in, and it's a significant event. And conversely, we're dispatched on what we think is an echo level call, and we walk in and the person's sitting up just waiting for us. That happens every day. The same will probably happen here. They found that in a few occasions that they walked in and they needed to access EMS, and that's the reason for the paramedic, because the paramedic can start what the paramedic does immediately. The rule of thumb on this process is that if they find that they have to access EMS, the paramedic will then take over the patient care. They will follow the medical protocol for EMS, and we will call the big red fire truck and another ambulance to come in and take that patient and move them into the EMS side. Mesa didn't find that to happen very often, but if it did, that's where the safety net is in this system, and we think it is good. We think it provides definitive care on the scene for many patients. It reduces transports to the emergency departments. We believe it's a cost-effective alternative that should be looked at. And here are some of the frequent call responses that in evaluating what Mesa looked at and responded to and were able to be effective. These were the type of calls that they found were the most prominent that they were able to deal with in the field. So the objective is to be able to study the effectiveness of definitive care on scene with a nurse practitioner and paramedic, and study the benefits for the patient from receiving service from this scope of practice, to study the effects of the CCRU response model on patient satisfaction, examine emergency medical dispatch criteria, because our criteria has been built around what we know on the 911 side, and that's got to be evaluated as we go through this. We're going to examine the nurse practitioner protocols, and we have developed with Kaiser at least a draft set of standard protocols to be used for this, and we've shared those with EMS. Study the cost effectiveness of the model. We know the MESA experience, and they're going into their second year, and they've had very good experience with just the overall healthcare cost. We need to determine how that translates to Orange County, California, because our rates, our system is different here. That's just a snapshot for them. We need to see if it does the same thing here. And then ultimately, you want to study if this is an efficient and effective way, a model for the future of us to partner with our allied organizations in the community, and can we sustain it? And we've heard about this term mobile integrated healthcare model thrown about a lot. And we believe in our research that at least in other states that this is really gaining a foothold and having some dramatic impact on patient care. And I look back to, and we've had this discussion a lot in the fire services of where we came up from. This show's still on reruns, so it's good because we get to go back and kind of relive our youth, because many of us, you know, probably were driven into the fire service because of this show. But if you think about when EMS started in the 70s, we really didn't know at that time what we were stepping into. We had a good idea of it might have a positive outcome based upon the experience that we saw in the Korean and Vietnam Wars with field triage and being able to intervene with trauma-related events. But we really didn't know at that point in time how effective it was going to be. Well, many, many years later, we have, I think, one of the most, and I've worked all across the country, we have most, I think, one of the finest EMS systems in the United States. We have a depth of resources here that many people, I think, throughout the country envy. I think the benefits of looking at this program can build upon that past history. I really believe that we are in a position to be able to do this, to pilot it, and to address a lot of the things that you see on this slide. Now, one of the questions, and then I will be quiet and answer any questions that you might have, but one of the questions that has been asked from several folks since we're involved with one hospital and one transport provider is, how are you going to bill for this service? And the answer is, we're not. One of the processes that we evaluated from Kaiser and ourself and CARE is that this is a pilot program, and so CARE is going to bring an ambulance and equipment and provide that at no cost, and we will bring a paramedic at no cost, and Kaiser has allocated over $200,000 that will come to us to sustain or obtain the services of a nurse practitioner, and this pilot is simply that. We're going to pilot it. We're not going to charge the people that we go out on. That will have some economic impact on my budget, I can tell you that. But I think it's a worthwhile objective to go in, and we did that for a couple of different reasons. One is other hospitals are looking to see, is this a way, and we have a doctor from Kaiser in Nusing with us, emergency room physician. She's actually helped us with our development of our protocols. But one of the things the other hospitals said, and probably rightly so, is, well, is Kaiser trying to maneuver in and gain market? And the answer is no. That's not the intent. The intent is to see if this pilot works so that we can share that information with all of you and hopefully open the door for this type of process, not only within this county, throughout the county and the areas that we don't serve, but hopefully throughout the state, because we believe that through our research, this is a very viable model. With that, I'll go ahead and be quiet and answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Committee members have any comments? Go ahead, Ned.
That was an excellent presentation. Thank you. And I agree, very innovative idea. Couple issues. One, seems like there's the potential for abuse here, in the sense that you're going to start to get a lot of calls from people because you basically are providing home visits. So did they see that in Mesa, that there was an increase in the number of calls over what previously had been taken?
I don't think that was their experience. I think their experience was they saw some of the same people over and over again, but they were seeing them anyway through the system, because in many cases, the 911 system is the primary care provider for many folks. So, but they've only been in it 18 months, so that could occur.
Yeah.
That could occur.
The other one, other question: does this apply to children as well? Will you be screening children in the same fashion?
Correct. Yes.
John.
Thank you. Again, I agree with.
Push the button. Okay, again, I agree with Dr. Annis. I think that it's going in the right direction and something that we need to start thinking out of the box in terms of how care is delivered and things. Could you articulate what your processes would be for necessary follow-up after care to one of your visits? I noticed that in the materials here, we saw somebody with back pain and receiving medications and things and walking out of the ambulance. I would assume that there might be some advice for follow-up for that gentleman. How would follow-up be integrated into this?
We're going to follow, I think, what Mesa, their experience was, and they actually followed up on every call the next day. And in some cases, actually went back and visited the patient to make sure that they were okay. Again, the objective was to make sure that what they did in the field was appropriate and solve the issue for the patient. But it was also to they found it as a excellent way to be an educational process, because a lot of the folks that they were seeing were diabetics, were having chronic issues, whether it's diabetes or whatever. And so they found that their follow-up visits actually helped them to, number one, connect them better with their primary care physician, but also provided them an opportunity for education. And so, yes, they did follow up the next day on all of their calls. And then all of their charts were reviewed by the physician, Dr. Gary Smith, who was the lead physician and is Mesa's physician supervisor. All of the charts were reviewed weekly.
To follow up on Dr. Gilroy's question, when a medical provider, whether it's a nurse practitioner or physician, sees a patient, we provide discharge instructions about things, if things have gotten worse. For example, in your case, the back pain that was brought up, for example, if it were persistent or if they get numbness down their legs or incontinence or things like that. So do you have a standard protocol for that, I think is what we're getting at, is if that's going to be provided to patients, and two, in terms of who is going to see this patient to make sure that they're better? Are you referring them back to their primary doctors or to Kaiser?
No, they won't be referred back to Kaiser unless Kaiser is their medium for health care.
Mm-hmm.
So they will be referred back to their primary care physician if they have one. And if not, and we've had some discussion about how we can encourage them to sign up for health care, because a lot of the folks that we see in the field don't have that. And with the Affordable Health Care Act now, there's an avenue where maybe we can support them and connect them with people that can help them get on the health care. So that's one thing. Yes, I think there will be there will be sheets that will say, if we're going to treat and release you here, if these things happen, depending upon the type of event. And that's not too dissimilar to what we tell people now that sign off in the field and say, I don't want to be transported to a hospital. We always leave them with, if this and this happens, you need to either call 911, or, and we always encourage them to see their primary care physician if they have one. Sometimes you know that they don't, and sometimes they don't follow up real well, but yes, that information will be left with them.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Yes, I have a comment. I think it's a wonderful program. You've done a great presentation here. Some of the questions that I would have, one of the challenges that we face in Orange County is availability of psychiatric beds. That's why they board in the emergency room for 3 days. So, and another part of that is medical clearance prior to acceptance into some of these places. So that would be great if we had availability to send these folks this way. It would really be beneficial to the patient. They get the right kind of treatment, because they don't get that currently in an emergency room. But I'm just curious, how are you going to handle that here in Orange mm-hmm. County? Maybe Mesa didn't have those same concerns. I'm not sure.
No, I don't think they have the same barriers as we do. And I think that's one of the areas that we're going to collectively have to work on, because we won't be able to institute those additional type of avenues of treatment until we reduce that barrier that exists today. But I think that can be done. It's not going to be done by one fire service provider, but I think collectively with county EMS and other providers coming to the table, understanding this and understanding that eventually they often get those patients anyway. So why don't we get them there 2 days earlier? And how can we do that? And what bureaucracy do we have to reduce to actually get them there quicker, so that we can start to have quality intervention with them sooner? I think that's the objective, but don't have the answer totally to that. But I think that's has to be one of our objectives as we move forward, is how we bridge that gap.
I just have a couple more here. One is you mentioned if they referral back to a physician. A lot of times we find that patients come to the emergency room because they don't have a physician.
Mm-hmm.
So for follow-up purposes, how do you know yet how you're going to do that?
Yeah, the unit itself, the people that are assigned to that unit will follow up the next day with the individuals that they had contact with the day before, or, you know, it might be 2 or 3 days before, depending upon the mechanism of injury or what they treated. But I think that there's an opportunity there that people that don't have any insurance and a primary care physician, that they can assist them with at least pointing them in the right direction of how to do that. Again, we've had some discussion that has really come out of our discussions in the city of Anaheim about how we're trying to address our homeless issue. There are a lot of services out there that can be brought to the table to assist these people. And one of the things that we haven't done, I don't think, a very good job in the fire service is having those folks at our fingertips when we engage these folks in the field and say, look, veterans are a good example. You know, about 35-40% of our homeless people are veterans. And there's a resource for them that can help them get off of the street. Well, what better way for the firefighter medic and EMT in the field to be able to say, here, we will help you. Here's who you can call, and if you can't do it, we'll bring somebody here to assist you to address your issues. And I think that goes across the board with folks that we see. So we think that there's an avenue there that we can help them to plug into the right services that they need if they don't have them now.
Okay, one more.
Go ahead.
I won't ask any more questions right now.
They're all good.
One of the questions also is, and this is something, again, that happens when somebody comes to the emergency room and we give them narcotics. If there's nobody there at home with them, is the plan to treat some of these pain issues with narcotics? And if so, what happens afterwards?
Doctor, would you like to take that? Because I think the protocols establish that there would be no narcotics used.
Basically, we would use Toradol. We would not use narcotics.
Okay.
If we give a prescription for Norco, I think that is still one of the protocols, but that would be something that we dispense patients home with anyway. So it's nothing different from what we do in the emergency.
They're not dispensing. They're just writing a script. Okay. Okay, thank you.
Can I ask a question for the physician who's overseeing the program? First of all, if the nurse practitioner has a question, is a physician who's supervising them available?
Discuss the nurse practitioner will practice within their scope of practice. They will be comfortable with what they're treating. If there is any question that they are uncomfortable, they will transport the patient. We will be available, but I think the program in Mesa, what they found was that it is better when there's any question to transport the patient.
Okay. And then secondly, it seems like the committee members are concerned about the follow-up, not just a follow-up phone call, but the follow-up in terms of them having further medical care. Are you going to be providing either a list, given that some, you know, patients may not have primary care providers or have access to health care, and they're not necessarily just homeless, but, you know, middle class and so forth. A lot of people don't have a primary care provider or do not have insurance. I mean, medically, legally, since you are providing care, what is your plan?
It's the same as we do in the emergency department. We treat the acute condition. We'll treat the back pain. We'll tell them to follow up with their primary care doctor. We'll give them a list of these are the things to watch for if it's not getting better, the numbness, tingling, incontinence, things like that. And then the other thing is that we give them resources. If they don't have insurance, we give them a list of resources. These are the possibilities for follow-up for primary care if you don't have insurance. So we can't, you know, the Kaiser patients we can obviously plug into an appointment, but non-insured patients, nobody can provide them anything other than resources.
So a list of clinics?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead, Ms.
I have one other question. And when you started your presentation, you mentioned that this is a proposal that has been submitted to the state. What is the relationship with this and the other community paramedicine pilot that I assume is now going? It's down, what, Newport, that area?
Are you asking me or are you asking them?
Well, the state wrote back to us and said that that our program didn't fit into their pilot criteria, and that actually that this is an existing scope of practice, and that would be under the direction of your you know, your physician supervisor in the county, and that you should go talk to him.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a couple questions too. Actually several questions. Number one, for colleagues here, page 9 in the handout that you put talks about provisions for protecting patient safety. It mentions a lot of those things. What happens if a patient doesn't have, you know, the doesn't have insurance? There'll be a physician's referral list. So on page 9, a lot of the questions from that point of view, for me, at least, it answered a lot of my questions, and also a lot of the data gathering in that document. Mesa, are they partnering with Kaiser, or is it with the local hospitals? Do you know?
They partner just with a local private hospital.
Okay,
initially,
so
and then now I think it's expanded out. They've had two or three other hospitals now that have come into the fold with them.
I know one of the concerns, you know, is it just Kaiser or whatever, but it seems like it in Mesa it's working with a myriad of emergency rooms and hospitals.
Correct.
Okay. And a couple more questions here. In your presentation, it also talked about it's a partnership between, you know, hospitals, fire departments, and ambulances. So it is a community partnership. It's not just a fire department-driven thing.
Correct.
Or okay. Let's see. I have a couple other ones here. I'm also on the, I think I'm just to reiterate some of your comments, I'm on the Commission on Homelessness in Orange County. And, you know, with our homeless population, a large portion of the homeless population has mental health issues. And again, I didn't quite get the total answer on that. How will this impact our mental health patients? I know it was up there on your slide.
Well, we're hoping that ultimately it will impact those patients because we're, as I discussed with Sharon a little bit, we're going to try and create that bridge back to those ancillary services that are not readily available today. That's going to take some time, but I think we can do that.
Will that program, will that, some of the data collection will help on that issue, or is that?
Yeah, absolutely. We're engaged in the homeless initiative in the city. We actually have our nurse manager that actually goes to all of those meetings. We've already changed our EPCR reporting to capture whether they're homeless or not, because we're trying to, again, get that level of statistic to tell us exactly, you know, what our numbers are. And then the types of issues that we're seeing with that population. And that data will drive then discussions of what do we need to do. We know we've got an issue with mental health, substance abuse, but what other chronic illnesses are we seeing, and what would be the education or intervention levels that we need to bring to the table for that group of individuals that would affect positive change long term? And so, yes, we're fully engaged in that.
Also, I know any kind of new program, there's, you know, other people involved, you know, Nurses Association, Physician Associations. Have you talked to any of those agencies, or has anybody been in discussions with them?
Yes, we have been in discussions with not only the state, but the National Nurse Practitioner Group. And the response has been rather positive. I wouldn't say that they're full on board yet, but they said, you know, this sounds like it's in our scope of practice. We think that it sounds like a really innovative idea. And in fact, we have a meeting with them next week. They're more concerned, honestly, in our discussions, they're more concerned about the community paramedicine program than they are about this program. But I think they're kind of taking a wait-and-see attitude until they see how this rolls out. But they've been ultimately, I think, fairly positive. I should point out, and you bring up other groups, you know, one of the big issues that I think most fire service has or has had is, and Mesa's no different, was with their labor group, their firefighters association. We engaged ours early on, and we actually sent them down to Mesa twice on our initial visit, and then subsequently, as we got into this a little bit more and we kind of put the framework around what we thought it might look like, we sent them down for three additional days and let them talk to the folks in the field, on the rigs, what the impact was for the system there. And I think they understand, they're on board, have been very supportive of this.
Okay. And lastly, I was looking through there, and so every patient is contacted within 48 hours afterwards by the nurse practitioner or a physician,
or the paramedic. Somebody will follow up with them, most likely the nurse practitioner. A lot of the folks, that's the goal. One of the things that they found in Mesa was that a lot of the follow-up was difficult because a lot of these folks, especially if they are homeless, hard to find. But that is the goal. That's the objective.
I don't even know if our inner facility goes that far. I don't think, you know, that's a lot of work. So that's pretty good patient protection. So,
that's it.
Mr. Davis.
Chief, nice presentation. But I have one question. In your pilot program, you have a huge city. Are you just going to have one unit that handles these calls? Or are you going to have multiple units in your pilot program to handle a large number of patients?
Excellent question. I'm sorry I didn't cover that. This is going to be one unit. And it's going to run 40 hours a week. And we did a fair amount of analysis on where this unit should be located citywide. And you're right, we're really spread out. And this unit probably will be located in the Beach, Orange area, Station 11, Station 4 area for us. But predominantly, that is where we get a significant high call volume. But we also see that there are over 50% low acuity type calls. And so that's where we're going to place this unit.
Does the city of Mesa, they're out of their pilot program, and this is in effect, do they get any type of reimbursement from Medicaid or anybody like that where it would offset some of your costs down the line?
They, not yet, but they have met with both Arizona Medicaid, I don't know what they call it there, and Medicare nationally. I think they were just awarded a multi-million dollar CMS research grant to take this process to the next level. And I think that will come. But I think as we've seen with other funding mechanisms, especially when you're dealing with federal and state government, that sometimes lags behind 2 to 3 to 4 or more years before we see that. So that's our hope, that if you know, this pilot is successful here, that the state will start to drive that discussion federally as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Chief Brugman, great great pilot. I think it's interesting. It's something that, in my experience statewide for a couple of decades, has been kicked around and talked about, so it's nice to see somebody trying to do something about it. I am curious, since it's not a 100% full-time car, is there any plan to try to capture the patients, either when the car's not staffed or redundant calls, the number of patients that would have been candidates for this program that wind up being handled by the BMS 911 system? I'm curious about the fallouts and how that will compare to the number you can capture, and anything you can do to contrast the care that's given and the amount of time committed to those two patient populations.
Well, I think that's an excellent suggestion, because that would be relatively easy to extrapolate with the data. Once you have the base data and then overlay that on what's happened overnight, that because you weren't there, what did you miss? So I think we could do that very easily. Excellent point.
Okay, I have a couple more questions for you. I said I would stop, but I didn't. Okay. Two questions. One is, would the NP have access to the same medications that the paramedics would have access to? Sometimes your calls, as you mentioned, you might think it's a low acuity call, but you get there and it's something totally different, like maybe somebody having a seizure. So would they have access to benzodiazepines? And
yeah, I think that's why we're talking about pairing them so that you can handle any kind of calls. And
good.
Hepatitis, and it ends up a seizure kid or something like
okay.
That.
Okay. And then just screening of the calls when they come in. You mentioned that a little bit, but can you explain that in a little more detail, how they screen those calls to differentiate and decide whether one is considered low acuity versus high acuity?
Well, there's a system in place in most dispatch centers, and I'll probably call upon Dr. Stratton here to help me explain this, but it's a tree of questions that lead you to, is this a, you know, echo level, very, very serious call, or an alpha level call? And so we've already built a similar tree that kind of branches off after you ask them two or three questions and you've determined it's not acute. There are two or three other questions that would lead them into this area. That has not been reviewed by Dr. Stratton yet, so we'll have to work through, get his blessing on that. But I think we can get to that point through a line of questioning. Here's the balance, though, and this is something that we may have to dispatch both units on some calls initially. I'm talking about an EMS-related response and this nurse practitioner call, until we have some more familiarity with being able to effectively screen those calls out.
So you're talking about an algorithm of how you're going to do it. Who is making that decision? Who's making the decision based on the algorithm? Do you know that yet?
The dispatchers will make that decision. Yes.
Okay.
Just as they do today.
And now these are going to be 911 dispatchers.
Correct.
Yeah. And I think it, like the interfacility ones, it actually goes to Dr. Stratton, the interfacility one, doesn't that go to either the ambulance company or the convalescent home or something? That doesn't go through 911, correct?
Correct. The dispatch is through MetroNet, which is a multi-jurisdictional dispatch center that follows the medical priority dispatching system That's been was developed originally by Jeff Clausen, who's in with the University of Utah and in Salt Lake City. Based on questions about is the patient breathing, is the patient awake, you know, basic things like that, dispatchers are trained to dispatch really five different levels of response. So that's been in effect for many years at MetroNet, which is our main dispatch center. The Fire Authority also has a dispatch center, which is the second primary one in Orange County, and they're currently in the process of adopting a prioritized dispatch system. And in MetroNet, the dispatchers are trained. They follow an algorithm that they're not allowed to vary from, so they have a practice guideline. They're QI'd, and those algorithms, even though they're nationally adopted in many EMS systems, are approved by the local EMS medical director. So I approve those and go over them. And the lowest acuity call is what's called an alpha call among five different categories, and the alpha calls would be the ones that are being picked off for this. So if a person's awake, alert, normal breathing, conscious, and essentially doesn't give any signs over the phone of physical distress, really, then this unit would be appropriate to do the initial assessment. The unit will have a capability of upgrading the call, which is already in effect anyway for low-level calls that go out. The other thing about the medical priority dispatch, I don't know if I said it, but there's a great deal of scientific research that's been done on that to evaluate those protocols and whether they're effective or not. There's outcome research to support it.
Thank you. Any other comments? Go ahead, John.
I just had one comment, and it's certainly not meant to detract from this, because I think this is a very innovative discussion and proposal that you've brought forward. I guess the concern that kind of comes to mind, and maybe this is more in line of a comment, but as long as this is a service that is being accessed through 911, we are now starting to go down the road of maybe evolving 911 to something that includes a non-emergency scope of service. So if I know, I can call 911 because I'm having some minor, you know, medical event or something. It's just a concern about the message that we're sending out there with doing this, and then where we're making the distinction between emergency 911 critical assistance versus,
sure.
You know, well, I don't really feel like driving down to the doctor's office or trying to make an appointment. There's just a conflict there.
Well, I think that gets back to the doctor's comment, and I think, you know, as we get into the pilot, if we see that, we're going to have to address that.
I think that even exists now. I think the 911.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right.
You know, it's basically a triage center for medical calls. What I like about this, as opposed to what the county approved before, the interfacility, is trained medical priority dispatch. Or dispatchers are making the call, as opposed to somebody in a company or somebody in a convalescent home or something that's making the call. It goes through the 911 system, and I hope I'm correct in that. Correct. So that's what gives me a little bit of relief knowing that.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We're going to move forward. The next item under new business is EMS system core measures.
Yeah, and I'll take that. The state of California, it's really a national Department of Transportation and NHTSA, a number of national groups are developing data systems, core measurement systems to allow local EMS agencies, states, and others to compare their performance among others that submit data to systems. California is requiring that each LIMSA, including Orange County, submit data to a state core database. And we have in the packet, if you look in your packet toward the back and look at page 2 of 5, there are 5 pages of the data that recently was submitted to the state. But page 2 of 5, in the interest of time, I'll just use that page to go over some of the data that we have for the system. This data is from October through December of 2013. And just going down the reporting value column, which is 4 columns from the left, if you look, for example, TRA1 is the on-scene time for level 1 trauma, and it reports the 90th fractile, 90% fractile. So 90% of runs that are high-level trauma, the on-scene time is 22 minutes and 48 seconds. That's the reported value. And just going down quickly, realizing the time factor here, of the cases during that period of time, it was only 33, which is the denominator, that met level 1 trauma or high-level trauma cases. 91% were transported to a trauma center. Going further down, ACS1 is the number of patients who met criteria because of chest pain or cardiac symptoms to have aspirin administered in the field. 94% of the time, that core criteria was met. Those that met criteria for an electrocardiogram, this is ACS2. Those that met criteria for an electrocardiogram in the field, 82% of the time an electrocardiogram was done. So in that one core measure, our system may fall below other systems in California. Our on-scene time for cardiac, for STEMI patients, myocardial infarction patients, was 20 minutes. That's very much within the norm for the nation. Of our STEMI patients that were found to be positive, out of 80, 78 or 98% were transported to a cardiovascular receiving center. Moving down to CAR2, that's the percent of patients in cardiac arrest in the field that had return of spontaneous circulation. Or a pulse return while in resuscitation in the field. And our reported value for that is 25%, which is right in line with national and state criteria or standards. The next two values we don't have values for, it's survival to hospital admission, survival to hospital discharge. Those values are ones that we will be seeking. We have to work out how to get this information from the receiving hospitals. It's data used to compare what our system with others using what is called the Utstein system of comparing cardiac arrest data. 84% of the time, STR2, 84% of the time, glucose was tested for a stroke patient. Our criteria or policies and procedures should get us at more at 100%, so we're falling way below a standard and a norm there. On-scene time for stroke patients was 19 minutes. Of those stroke patients, 91% of the time, this is STR5, of stroke patients that met criteria, 91% were transported to stroke centers. Respiratory 2 and PEDS 1, these data are requested by the state. Most of the medical directors in the state are having trouble figuring out what they're looking for, but it basically is an assessment of how many times albuterol or a beta agonist is given to somebody in respiratory distress, 40% of the time for adults, 29% for children. And again, that data is, there's no standards that are known for that right now. Where our system fell probably below others for sure is in PA1, PAI1, which is a measurement of how often when someone was reported to have a pain scale greater than or equal to 7, they received something for the pain in the field, and our measure, realizing this is our initial measures, was 66% of the time the pain was addressed in the field in those patients. So this is something through our QI system and through training we'll have to address, obviously from these core measures. Our SKL1, getting down to the bottom, is our intubation success rate after two attempts or at two attempts. It's 73%. Our system, Los Angeles and San Diego, actually go to three attempts. So 73% really doesn't reflect what our system's targets are, but that falls within the national norm for two attempts anyway. And of those that were intubated, 86% of the time, end-tidal CO2 numeric value was reported, which is actually very good. Most systems in California are just now adopting end-tidal CO2 numeric, whereas our system has established that as a standard many, actually 2 to 3 years ago. So we will be using these core measures to make reports to this group. I think the more important thing is that only a few LIMSAs in the state or in the nation have been able to do any core measures at all. And this reflects how robust our OC Med system is, that we can pull this data and report it and then be able to compare ourselves to other systems and address areas that may be a concern, like the pain, addressing pain. So, as I said, I think that this really reflects how far advanced we are over many other systems with our data system, OC Meds, and I will look forward to myself and staff presenting reports similar to this, probably using graphs and pictures and things like that, a little, not so much a crude report in the way it's written to this committee in the future. I can answer any questions on that, Ron. Or Mr. Blau, however we're supposed to address each other.
You're Dr. Stratton. How are the core measurements chosen?
The core measurements were chosen actually by a multidisciplinary committee that met at the state level. So these are state-selected core measures. The definitions, that's, you know, where the devil is in any of these types of things. So the definitions are also determined by the state. So some of them, like referring to the intubation success rate, some of them are different than what our county and some of the other large urban counties use, because they reflect, you know, the whole state.
And do they match up with a national data set as well, or yeah, is it more expansive, or can you characterize that at all?
Yeah, there is a national core data set that has been developed and is being collected, and they do match up to that. It's a little more expansive. There's a few more items that have been selected for measurement in California over that basic national core measure.
Sam, I have one question. The end-tidal CO2 monitoring, is that used solely for the to determine the success of intubation, or are you also using that as a gauge of the effectiveness of chest compression?
It's primarily intubation, and so it's a measure of success of intubation because the entitled CO2 obviously increases. There's more carbon dioxide if you're into the right. lung and ventilating. It's measured also if there's an onset of perfusion. There's often a perfusion wave that can be tracked. But also the primary reason we implemented it is if you have a good end-tidal CO2 that drops, then we assume that the ET tube has been displaced,
okay.
which is a huge risk in the field.
Yeah.
So it's not to look at chest compression as much as monitoring the ventilation and lung perfusion in a sense. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Sam. Next on the agenda, member comments. Any committee members have any comments or questions at this time? No. Okay. All right. We're going to open the forum to public comments. Please keep in mind, keep your comments to 3 to 5 minutes. None? Okay. None at this time. So unless anyone has any other comments, we will be adjourned until June 27th. All in favor of adjournment?
Aye.
Second? We're adjourned.